This is it. This is what the living do.
This is what the living do. Sometimes the living record podcasts in which people they admire and love from afar read them a poem and answer their most burning questions. This is what Kim Rosen did for me a few weeks ago. It was lovely. One of the burning questions I had for Kim was, out of the many, many poems she's learned by heart, taught from heart, written about heartfully, what makes her say yes to one poem and not another? What makes her want to begin that journey with the poem by her side?
It's a great question, you know, because I do start to learn poems that I don't finish. And I also learn poems that don't stick. And I will say parenthetically that sticking is a collaborative event, both between the poem and its relationship to my energy system, but also my own, the work that I put in. But the poems that I learned by heart are, honestly, they're the poems that I need personally in my life for one reason or another. It doesn't honestly feel like I'm the one that's picking so much as a hunger in me is choosing what it needs. And it may be because of the content of the poem, like the poem that I'm going to speak for you today, the poem by Marie Howe called What the Living Do. At the time that I chose to learn it, and I've been learning it over many, many years, because it's not a poem that has stuck easily within me. At the time that I learned it, it wasn't particularly because of anything in my life. It wasn't, say, because of a death in my life. It was ostensibly because the poem moved me so deeply, but I didn't really know why I was drawn to it.
Would you like to speak it for us?
Sure, sure. So this is What the Living Do by Marie Howe. Johnny, the kitchen sink has been clogged for days. Some utensil probably fell down there. And the Drano won't work, but smells dangerous. And the crusty dishes have piled up waiting for the plumber I still haven't called. This is the everyday we spoke of. It's winter again, the skies a deep, headstrong blue, and the sunlight pours through the open living room windows because the heat's on too high in here and I can't turn it off. For weeks now, driving, dropping a bag of groceries in the street, the bag breaking, I've been thinking, this is what the living do. And yesterday, hurrying over the wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my wrist and sleeve, I thought it again. And again later, when buying a hairbrush. This is it. Parking, slamming the car door shut in the cold. What you called that yearning. What you finally gave up. We want the spring to come and the winter to pass. We want whoever to call or not call, a letter, a kiss. We want more and more and then more of it. But there are moments walking when I catch a glimpse of myself in the window glass, say the window of the corner video store, and I'm gripped by a cherishing so deep for my own blowing hair, chapped face, and unbuttoned coat that I'm speechless. I am living. I remember you.
Thank you.
My father died last month. And so this poem is close to me in a way it hasn't been before, even though it was close to me in other ways before.
I'm really sorry to hear your dad died so recently.
Yeah. It was, you know, he was 90, almost 93. But it's always, I can't say always from personal experience. It's the first time my father has ever died. But from what I hear from the beautiful streams of compassion that have come towards me, it's no matter how understandable it is, it's a huge shift. And it certainly gives this poem an aliveness.
So what are there particular lines, you know, since your dad's death that have a new aliveness, that have kind of taken on a different kind of force or a different kind of pressure?
Well, I think really that last segment that we've been talking about, the cherishing piece, you know, I that segment has actually always totaled me in a good way, because I think being so in the midst of the poem, it always kind of takes me by surprise and gets under my armor in a way. But it just feels very alive for me. And the last few words, of course, they often break me open. Those last few words, they broke me open for years before I had a death that was this close to me. But certainly they do break me open now. I am living. I remember you. It says so much that.
And when you were reading it, and I wasn't actually looking at your face, but it's interesting that your voice, what I loved about your speaking of the poem was that you start in a very kind of matter of fact way, and I like that kind of matter of factness. You know, you weren't doing it in a sort of high you know, kind of highfalutin poetry voice way, which suits the poem needs that, I think, because this is, you know, this is what the living do.
Teaches that is one of the great lessons, both as a poem, you know, in terms of a lesson for poets. This poem teaches that in an amazing way, but also as, you know, just a lesson for human beings. This poem is in the thick of the mundane, you know.
Yeah.
So as you were saying,
And then, but then I noticed that at a certain point, because as I say, I wasn't looking at your face whilst you were reciting it, although I could see when I looked up at you, because we are doing this interview over Skype, and I can see you. That you were visibly moved as well, but I could hear, there was a moment when I could hear your voice softening, and I could hear that you were moving into a space of of deep emotion, and of deep reflection, which makes the hearing of the poem and the sharing of the poem, of course, such a completely different thing to just reading it on the page, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. Totally different from reading it on the page, for me anyway. But also, I feel like when we speak poems to other people, the greatest gift we can give is to be in deep connection with them, but in primary connection with ourselves, so that we're not reciting the poem for someone else, but we're inviting them into the communion of allowing this poem to take us by storm. And the only way to do that is for me to, And it's a wonderful obligation. It's a beautiful obligation for me to, in communion with you, to allow the poem to take me by storm.
What I also loved about your speaking of it, and I was very interested to actually hear that, and particularly for a poem that you have yourself said you've been working on this poem and you know, reciting it for a number of years, was that it still felt very fresh. I almost felt like there were pauses and there were moments when I could almost felt like I could hear the sort of cogs of your brain whirring. I felt like I could hear the poem still working its way through you, almost like trickling down like water in a way. Which of course you would never get if you were to read that poem.
It's very different. For me, it's very, very different than reading it. And, you know, this poem, I think all the poems that I, you know, it's like your circle of close friends, right? There's a lot of people who don't get into that circle, right? I mean, at least for me, I have maybe six close friends that I call my composite guru, you know? And there are a lot of people I love, but if you're a poem and you live in my body and I write you on my bones, that poem is going to be alive for me every time I say it. You know, I am going to discover new experience, new aliveness, new pulsation, new places that tears spring to my eyes or my voice changes. And it's not because I'm trying to keep myself interested or I'm trying to give it variety. It just happens because I meet that poem like, you know, like hopefully some people know how to meet their husbands and wives. Like, oh, who are you today? You know?
So the poem is addressed to a man, or it could be a young person. This Johnny, I mean, who is this Johnny for you?
That's a good question. For many years, the Johnny was, I didn't even think of somebody, but it was not somebody I'd lost, but it was someone that I loved. And for me, that yearning, you know, I've been through that. That's a very, very powerful line for me also. And I've walked with people towards their deaths, a number of people. And I have seen that there's a point in most of them where there's a complete 180 degree change. And that whatever was yearning, whatever was reaching out for whatever it might have been, let's go. And they enter into a very different relationship to life, you know. And it's a fascinating thing to see. I saw it happen with my father, you know, where things start to matter less and less, and they are drawn into I don't know where, but they're drawn somewhere else.
But it's interesting because, as you say, that yearning, in a way, from what I understand, from what you're saying, is the mundane yearning, which is for spring to come, for winter to pass, for people to call or not call, the letter, the kiss, for all of that and more of that, is sort of replaced by another yearning, by perhaps a more spiritual yearning, but there's still the yearning. It does seem like, I think it's key, that line, isn't it? Because we are creatures of yearning, whether we're yearning for the mundane or whether we're yearning for the extra mundane. We're always it seems like we're always yearning for something.
That's not my experience.
No,
I have to say that's not my experience. I mean, I certainly spent most of my life, I called it longing, but longing and yearning, they're delicious words. And I spend a lot of my life yearning, but I must say that I am not located in the yearning. I realize that I've been lucky enough to be relocated, you know, to be relocated into a quality an experience of living that is about presence, And there is yearning, and it's my nature to yearn. I'm a love dog. You know that poem by Rumi, you know, one night a man was crying, Allah, Allah, his lips grew sweet with the praise. You know, I am a bhakti. I love my yearning, but I also am very grateful to have been relocated in a fullness of presence that dissolves yearning.
And
it totally disoriented me when it first happened, I must say.
Do you find that the learning of the poetry grounds you and anchors you? Because
it always does.
Yeah.
It always does. It humbles me. It reels my mind in. If I can just, I mean, when I was going through the period right after my father's death, which was, you know, a blessed expected death, so it wasn't terrible, but it was hard. You know, they don't tell you about the avalanche of details that falls on your head as soon as somebody dies. And it was hard work. Learning a poem by Wendell Berry and a poem by Rumi were what saved me. They really did. There's a beautiful poem by Wendell Berry called Elegiac Poem. It's the third section of a three-part poem called Elegiac Poem, and a poem by Rumi called Autumn Rose Elegy. And those poems, I would be, you know, going to the funeral home, dealing with details, dealing with, you know, the Veterans Administration and stopping his credit cards and the banks and the, you know, the car, blah, 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 you know. And while I was driving, I would come back to these poems and they would remind me why I was doing this, who I was doing it for, the depth of what was going on. Mm-hmm. Do you know? So they always bring me back, always.
Are there any lines in this poem, any particular lines that maybe we haven't discussed that have that ability to bring you back from that sort of, you know, as you've described so well, that sort of mad fluster of sort of headspace to something a little bit more in the body, more rooted?
The whole poem, I have to say, the whole
right.
poem. The lines that, you know, I love the lines. And yesterday, hurrying over the wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, no, not the wobbly bricks, those wobbly bricks. Hurrying over those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my wrist and sleeve. Hurrying over those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge. You see, it brings me back. Hurrying over those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk. Say that yourself, and you cannot be anywhere but right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right there, whether you've ever been to Cambridge, Massachusetts or not, you, because of the amount of focus that it takes to hurry over the wobbly bricks of that line.
Mm. So this is what you were saying before about it being as much about the sort of the rhythmic quality and actually what's going on with your mouth and mind at the same time, that can take a line that is not necessarily particularly profound, but has a profound resonance, it sounds like, for you.
The rhythm of that line is profound. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we who are not schooled in writing poetry, which is most of the world who appreciates poetry, didn't go to class. We tend to think that the reason the poem is touching us is because of the meaning of the words. And it's just not true. It's because the poem has a whole medicine bag of ways that it gets inside of us. Even if you're just reading it on the page, the rhythms of that line get inside you and break up the encrustations of habit. You know, the sound of your own voice saying it gets in literally inside you. It resonates your bones and the crystals within your fascia. So so that when we get to that line, that famous line that of Mary Oliver, where she, you know, at the end of the summer day, that everybody quotes, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? When we get to that line, we go, oh my God, that poem is amazing. That was amazing. And then we write the line down and we make a Hallmark card of it. What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And somehow it just doesn't have the potency. It has a potency. It's still a potent line, and it's still got enough strangeness in it that it's not a Hallmark card. But it was the entrainment of the whole poem that took us there so that that line could go completely under our armor. You know what I'm saying?
Which is sort of what this poem is also about, isn't it? It's about that within the mundanity of what the living do and all of the bits and pieces that make up our lives that we hardly think about most of the time, there are those moments of recognition in some way when we do catch a glimpse of ourselves in the window glass and just the strangeness of being there and alive and present to ourselves for a moment completely fells us.
It fells us, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about, that not just the meaning of a poem does, but the rhythm and the sounds melt us so that the poem can come in and go direct to the heart.
Well, that sounds like I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. Thank you so, so much. It's been absolutely lovely. I really want to do one of your workshops, hopefully one day when
I spend a massive amount of time in Ireland and Wales this summer.
Yeah.
There's the closest I get to, are you in London?
Yeah.
Yeah. Closest I get to London is going to be in Wales at a retreat center called Ceridwen. Yeah.
Right. Thank you so much, Kim. Have a lovely day. And
yes, you too. Have a lovely evening, and thank you for your deep connection to this work. I'm honored.
Thanks.
Bye.
This is it.